Good afternoon, everyone. I think we should make a start. Can I check that you can hear me? Excellent nods at the back, that's good. Welcome to this final seminar in the Glasgow Centre for Population Health's sixth seminar series. It's extraordinary for us to think that that's us now completed six seasons of these very interesting and diverse seminars, which Andrew Lyon uses his creativity and intellect and networks and sometimes a bit of perseverance to bring to Glasgow a range of interesting and diverse people to tell us about the work they do, how they see the world, and for us to think very carefully about what that might mean about how we go about our work here in Glasgow with an objective of improving health, well-being and sustainable communities in this part of the country. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Carol Tannehill and I have the pleasure of being the director of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, and I am your chair for this afternoon's seminar. So my first task is the usual, just please make sure that phones are on silent at worst and switched off at best, please, and that would be great. If there is a fire alarm that goes off, the exit is at the end of this room, so please make your way out there. The format of this seminar is, after I finish my introduction, I will hand over to Adam, who will address us for somewhere between 3/4 of an hour and an hour, I think, telling us about power and love, more of which in a minute. And then we'll have a good half hour for discussion and questions and answers, following which there is a scope to network out in the lobby there and continue the conversations and discussion of your reflections on what you've heard this afternoon. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Adam Cahane, who has managed to avoid any volcanic ash problems and made his way here from Canada. Is that where you... Oh no, you've come from Brazil, I think. From Brazil to talk to us this evening. Adam is a leading designer and facilitator of processes through which different constituents from business, governance and civil society can work together to achieve progress to solve tough, complex social problems. And he has worked on some very, very tough, complex social problems. Through his career, he's worked in more than 50 countries in every part of the world and has facilitated a whole range of what sound to me from reading his work extremely challenging, but I think probably some of the most important problems that have faced the world over that period of time. He's facilitated the Montfleur Scenario Project in South Africa, in which a diverse group of South Africans worked together to effect the transition to democracy. What a phenomenal achievement. He's created an alliance of people from different parts of the global food system as a route to getting sustainable food more mainstream in the agenda and not of marginal interest. He's worked in Colombia during the Civil War, in Guatemala after the genocide to support the implementation of the peace accords, and with different sectors of Jewish-Israeli society. And that's only a few of his achievements, and I'm sure we're going to hear more examples this afternoon. From initially studying physics at McGill University, Adam then graduated with postgraduate degrees in economics and behavioural science. His career has involved strategy and research positions in large international organisations, involving him in living and working in many different parts of the world, though not yet in Scotland, I think, so maybe that's a pleasure for the future. He now lives in Boston and Cape Town with his wife and family, and is partner in Generan Rios, part of Rios Partners. Now, those of you with a classical training will know what Rios means. Flow. Is that right? Yes, it's flow. The focus being, therefore, on movement, achieving movement and progress forward. Rios Partners is a global partnership that supports innovation in complex social systems. From what I understand, the approaches are practical and can be applied at a range of different levels, from national levels to international systems, to local, organisational and community issues. So as you listen to what Adam's saying, I think one of the things to do is to think about how that might be applied at some of the different levels and in relation to some of the different social challenges that we face here. Adam is author first of this book, Solving Tough Problems, an open way of talking, listening and creating new realities. This was described by Nelson Mandela as a breakthrough book which addresses the central challenge of our time, finding a way to work together to solve the problems we have created. That sort of tribute must have made him feel pretty good, I guess. And it's only one of many tributes on this book. His more recent book, Power and Love, which is the subject matter of today's seminar, describes how these two processes, that of power and that of love, are the fundamental drives that generate social change and need to be employed together. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and as well as all of his other achievements, I can recommend Adam to you as a very clear communicator, whose propositions he makes in very persuasive and gripping ways. So it really is a good read, and I highly recommend it to you. So Adam, we're really delighted that you have come to join us this afternoon. We really look forward to hearing what you've got to say and to hear more about power and love. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carol, and thank you, Andrew, for persevering. It took several years to make this happen, so I'm happy to finally be here. I've never lived in Scotland, but I lived in London for 5 years, and I was walking through the streets near where I used to live last night, remembering what a wonderful feeling it is when the days get longer. So it made me nostalgic for being in the UK. Thank you. Thank you all for your interest and for coming. I'm happy to be here. As Carol said in her introduction, I've spent the past 20 years working with my colleagues on different sort of complex social challenges, working on climate change in my native country of Canada, and a bit in healthcare in the United States, on judicial impunity in Argentina, on child malnutrition in India, on violent conflict in Colombia and Sudan, unsustainable food systems in Europe and South Africa, social divisions in Australia. And when I think back on that work, one of the primary patterns that I've noticed is that complex social challenges tend to get stuck. It's difficult to create forward movement. Many, perhaps most of the efforts we try fail. There's no straight line, there's no recipes. The result, among other things, is frustration and suffering and pain. And this pattern has both frustrated me and also energized me for the work. And so I've spent the last 20 years, I would say, with much trial and much error and much learning, trying to work out why this is that complex social challenges tend to get stuck, and how to get unstuck, how to create forward movement or flow. The answer, or one of the answers I've come up with to the question that I've posed, has to do with these two words, power and love. And this answer immediately poses two challenges for an afternoon like today. I was telling a friend of mine who comes from very a proper upbringing in New York City that I was writing a book about power and love, and I could see from the expression on his face that he was genuinely concerned for me. He said, "Adam, you can't do that. You've chosen two words which are not permitted to be spoken in polite company." And I dismissed this, but then a few months ago I was writing to a a colleague in the Dutch government, and every time I would send him an email with the words power and love in the subject line, it would be rejected by the government spam filter. So God knows what category that fell in. Actually, my wife was alarmed to see that this new book was in the romance and sex aid section of a Boston bookstore, which she found quite embarrassing on my behalf. The other reason it's difficult to talk about power and love is these are words that are deliberately chosen ordinary words, but they mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And it so the difficulty I have in talking about it is that people believe that they know what I'm going to say before I say it, and don't listen. I'm talking about, as you'll see, I'm talking about power and love in a very specific way, using particular definitions. So what I'd invite you to do for the next 30-40 minutes is just take your understanding of power and love and suspend it as if from a string in front of you. You may find after 30 or 40 minutes that you think the same thing as you did before, but you may find that that the framework I'm offering helps you see something different and helps you look at things in a different way. So the first part of what I wanted to talk about is why is it that in trying to address complex social challenges we so often get stuck? I spent the first 2 weeks of December last year in Copenhagen, participating in a minor way in the United Nations negotiations on climate change. And for somebody who's interested in how to address complex social challenges, this was really like being at the Olympics. The city of Copenhagen was filled with people working in every different possible way on the challenge of climate change. There were conferences and church services, concerts. It seemed that on every street corner there was a protest, and on every billboard there was some message about climate change. There were 50,000 people who came to the civil society event, the Klima Forum, and in the middle of the first week of December there was a march through the streets of Copenhagen with 100,000 people, as hundreds of thousands of others were marching through hundreds of other cities around the world, I assume including Glasgow. I spent most of the time in the Bella Center, which was the venue for the official UN negotiations. As you may have seen on television, the Bella Center was filled literally to capacity with 20,000 people, official negotiators from 192 countries, and media people and business observers and NGO observers, all networked with each other and with their constituents and friends around the world. Every day at the Bella Center there were hundreds of official meetings and unofficial side meetings. I've never seen, let alone participated in, a gathering of such scale and seriousness and sophistication. Somebody said to me it was like being in a class where everybody was really interested in the material and everybody had done all of the pre-reading. The core dynamic I observed in the Bella Center was a collision between two camps, each with its own drive and its own discourse. And I'm not speaking here about the collision between rich countries and poor countries, or between people who wanted to move on climate change and people who didn't, although that collision certainly existed, but rather a collision that I think of as more fundamental. On the one side was what I call the power camp. You had the governments of the UK and the US and other industrialized countries who framed everything they said in terms of maintaining their position in the global system, their competitiveness. You had the countries of China and Brazil and my adopted country of South Africa and other industrializing countries talking mostly about growth and development. You had African countries and other poor and vulnerable countries talking about their development or even their survival. And then you had a motley crew of oil companies and shipping companies and windmill companies concerned with their growth and profits. what all of these different members of the power camp had in common is that their discourse was about their own need for development and growth and self-determination. On the other hand, you had, or the other side, you had what I am calling the love camp. And the love camp was perfectly exhibited in the opening ceremonies on the Monday of the first week in December. You had the Danish climate minister, who was the chair of the negotiations, who opened the meeting by talking about the responsibility of the negotiators who were there to deal with this issue, the importance of their task. You had Rajendra Pachauri, the head of the scientific body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, talking about global imbalances and ecological questions. You had a film that had been made just for the conference about children and what life would be like for children if climate change was not addressed and the ethical issues this raised. And then finally you had this beautiful singing by a Danish adult choir that opened the hearts of everybody in this huge meeting room. What all of the discourses or the discourse of all of the members of this love camp had in common was that they were all talking about interconnectedness and the health of the planet and humanity as a whole. These two distinct drives and discourses produced complexity and consternation and conflict, because these two camps were radically polarized. The power camp's view of the love camp was that the love camp was being impractical, even unrealistic. And the love camp view of the power camp was that the power camp was being irresponsible, even oppressive. Now, what was apparent to me then is that both of these camps are strong, and neither of them is going to go away. The power camp can ignore or deny the importance of the interconnectedness and health of the whole, but ignoring or denying the importance of the interconnectedness and health of the whole doesn't make these phenomena go away. I spent a fair amount of time there with a friend of mine who's a climate scientist, and he kept muttering under his breath, "You can't negotiate with Mother Earth." At the same time, the love camp can deny or ignore the importance of development and growth and sovereignty, but ignoring or denying the importance of development and growth and sovereignty doesn't make these phenomena go away. And sitting in the back of this negotiating room, some of the most telling and touching moments were when a man named Ian Fry would put his hand up to speak. Ian Fry was the negotiator for the country of Tuvalu, this little island in the Pacific, only 26 square kilometers, 12,000 people. The highest point on the island of Tuvalu is 4.5 meters above sea level. And several times from the very first session on the first day to the very last session on the last day, Ian would put up his hand and he would say some version of, I object to the way this negotiation is moving. If you continue to move in this direction, my country will cease to exist, and I simply cannot go along with this. So the way I saw it, this collision in Copenhagen between the power camp and the love camp was the collision of an irresistible force and an immovable object. And what we saw at the end of the second week in December, and what we still see, is that the climate situation is poised between breakdown and breakthrough, between being stuck and moving forward. And the question I was left with is, what will it take to move forward on this complex challenge? But when I thought about it further, I thought that what I had seen in Copenhagen was an extreme example of what is in fact a universal phenomenon, that the collision between power and love often produces breakdown and stuckness. And so the more general question is, what does it take to move forward on such complex social challenges? When I look back at the 20 years of work I've done, what I can now see in retrospect, it certainly wasn't obvious to me at the time, is that I have encountered this collision between power and love many times. I got started in this work in 1991. I was living in London, working in the scenario department of Royal Dutch Shell. I was the head of the political, economic, social scenario group. One day we received an unexpected phone call from a group of activists in South Africa associated with the African National Congress. Nelson Mandela had just been released from prison, the negotiations, the opposition movements had just been legalized, the negotiations to deal with the situation had just begun, and this group of opposition activists wanted to use the Shell scenario planning methodology to undertake strategic planning about how to end apartheid. Shell, you may remember, had been subject to a boycott, particularly in Europe, for not having divested from South Africa, and so they were very happy to oblige. And as I was the youngest and most expendable member of the department, I was dispatched. And this is how I found myself in September 1991, unexpectedly facilitating an exercise at a conference center outside Cape Town. The conference center is called Montfleur, of these people. What was most interesting and surprising and interesting to me about this experience was that the team I ended up facilitating was made up of people not just from the African National Congress, but from a variety of opposition movements, other political parties, trade unions, community activists, academics, and also members of the white establishment, business, and eventually members of the white Democratic Party and Conservative Party. There was a joke people used to tell in South Africa around that time, that faced with our unbelievably complex and daunting social challenges, we have actually two options. There's a practical option and there's a miraculous option. The practical option is right now we all get out of our chairs and down on our knees and we pray for a band of angels to come down and sort this out for us. And the miraculous option would be that we continue to talk with one another and find a way forward together. And of course, to everybody's surprise, and not least the South Africans, this version of the miraculous option eventuated. This was surprising and inspiring to me, and I became very interested in this way of working on complex social challenges, which I didn't know existed. I became very interested in what was going on in South Africa, a very exciting experience for a young man. I also became very interested in the woman who was the organizer of the project, and so by the end of the project I had resigned from Shell and emigrated from London to Cape Town and married the project organizer. So altogether a successful project. And what I learned from that experience, and which is the thread that I have been following for the 20 years since, is that under certain circumstances, I didn't really understand what circumstances, but under certain circumstances, it is possible to move forward on even the most complex and daunting social challenges, and I wanted to know what those circumstances were and how to do that. I've lived in South Africa since 1993, and when I think about what I've seen in South Africa at that time and since, and what I know about the history of South Africa before that, I realize that this collision between power and love has played out very, very clearly there. On the one hand, a power drive, which has been exhibited in a history of migration and slavery and colonialism and apartheid and armed conflict and peaceful resistance and negotiation. Just phase after phase of encounter between different people, each trying to get on with what they want, achieve what they want in various collisions of different sorts. And at the same time, a very important love drive. And I think that what has been so inspiring about the South African transition to the international community has been this aspect of the situation, so epitomized by the two leading figures of the transition, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with his emphasis on healing and reconciliation, and Nelson Mandela with his capacity to reunite the separated. Of course, the word apartheid in Afrikaans just means apartness. That's what the word means. And so the end of apartheid was, in a certain sense, the end of apartness. And the emblematic moment of this end of apartness, which is the subject of this new Clint Eastwood movie, Invictus, was this moment when Mandela went onto the pitch at the 1995 Rugby World Cup and took a symbol of white Afrikaner domination, rugby, and with a single gesture transformed it into a symbol of the unity of the nation as a whole. So there's something in the South African story which is also about the collision between power and love, and somehow, reasons that certainly weren't clear to me at the time, that this set of forces were able to be resolved in this miraculous fashion. Since then, my colleagues and I have worked with this South African approach in every part of the world on many different challenges, and the general form of the work has been, as I had seen in South Africa, to work with teams of leaders who come from across a given social system, who may not know each other, may not agree with each other, may not like each other, may have a history of literally shooting at each other, but who realize that they can't get where they're trying to go except together. And this has been the work of the last 20 years in which I have seen this collision between power and love many times. Now, when I thought about it, I realized that this collision between power and love, which I'd seen globally at Copenhagen and nationally in South Africa and many other places, I'd also seen in all the organizations I'd worked with, whether as a consultant to government or company or NGOs, or within Shell as an employee, or even within Rio's partners. That on the one hand, you had this crucial phenomena, this power drive, of every individual, every department trying to do its thing, get its job done, push forward its initiatives, its ideas. And at the same time, this love drive manifested in different ways as friendship or teammateship or common purpose of some sort. And finally, what I noticed is this same collision very strongly within myself, that I feel within myself a very strong drive, a drive to be myself, to do my thing, to achieve my destiny, and at the same time, a drive to connect with others, to be in communion with others. And I can certainly tell a version of my own biography, which is about this collision between the power drive and the love drive. So what's going on here? There's some phenomena that I've seen at the global level, at the national level, at the organizational level, at the personal level. What's this about? How can we understand this phenomena that is occurring at all social scales? The way I have come to think about this is that what we're seeing is a collision between two basic universal human drives. And of course there's many definitions of power and of love, but what I've settled upon is a pair of definitions that were offered by a German-American theologian whose name was Paul Tillich, who wrote a book, I think in 1955, called Power, Love, and Justice. And I've settled on these Tillich definitions not because I have any particular allegiance to Tillich. I'd actually never heard of him before I came across this book. I wouldn't say I'm an enormous follower of German-American Protestant existential theologians. It's not really not really a movement I see myself as part of, but Tillich's definitions to me have enormous explanatory value. Much of what I've encountered and have been trying to understand and work with over these 20 years in my professional work and in my personal life, I think can be explained by Tillich's definitions. Tillich defines power as the drive of everything living to realize itself with increasing intensity and extensity. The drive of everything living to realize itself with increasing intensity and extensity. And the clearest image I have of what Tillich means by power, have you ever heard of this NGO movement called guerrilla gardening? So guerrilla gardeners are people who skulk about at night in a built-up city like Glasgow. They find an empty lot that's covered with whatever garbage or tar, and they put seeds on the ground because they know that the seeds will sprout and go through the ground and the rubble and make a green space. And this image of the seed is, I think, the clearest image of what Tillich means by the drive of everything living to realize itself with increasing intensity and extensity. This is the drive to development and growth and self-determination, which I saw on exhibit in Copenhagen, in South Africa, in organizations, and in myself. Tillich defines love as the drive towards the unity of the separated. The drive towards the unity of the separated. And what he's implying by that particular choice of words is that there is an underlying unity. It's not one that has to be created, but which exists, which has been or which appears to be fractured. So this is the notion of interconnectedness or health or wholeness, which I saw on exhibit in Copenhagen and in South Africa and in organizations and in myself. Now, so far so good. If you think about this in a calm lecture room like this afternoon, sounds pretty straightforward. Drive to self-realization, drive to unity, I can do that. In theory, this is simple, but in practice, I've concluded that it's not only difficult, but dangerous. And the reason it's difficult and dangerous to work with these phenomena is because, as everybody knows, power has two sides. A generative side, this drive to self-realization can create things, can grow things like the seed, and a degenerative side, a side associated with oppression, with undermining the power of another. And the other reason it's difficult and dangerous to work with power and love is because, as not everybody knows, love also has two sides. A generative side and a degenerative side. I once took this course where a lot of my fellow students were from Texas. And the fun thing about studying with Texans is they have this really wonderful way of using the English language. And one of my friends said that his son had been in the Netherlands and had fallen in love. And he said, "When my son came home, he was so in love, he wasn't worth shooting." And I love this expression, this image of love which is so crippling, so sapping of one's power that one's not worth shooting. So these two sides of power and these two sides of love show up in human systems at all scales. Let me give you two examples, a small one and a larger one. I think the clearest way to see these two sides of power and these two sides of love is just to look at historically constructed gender roles. So in the historically constructed gender roles, the husband represents masculine power and the wife, feminine love. The man goes out of, the generative side of the man's power is he goes out of the house in the morning with his briefcase, and the generative side of his power is that he can participate in creating something in the world, in making something happen, in building something up. The degenerative side of his power, which is the subject of 100 novels and 100 films, is he can become so focused on this thing he has to do, his job, his destiny, that he becomes disconnected from his colleagues, from his family, and he becomes a robot or a tyrant. The two sides of love can be seen in the role of the woman. The generative side of her love is that she literally gives life to the children, figuratively to the family as a whole. The degenerative side of her love is that she can become so focused on this unity, on holding together, that she undermines or suffocates the power of the members of the family and much more fundamentally of herself. So I think this is this image, which certainly I recognize from families I've been close to, and maybe some of you do as well, is the clearest way to see this two sides of power, two sides of love. Let me give you a second example from my work. In 2006, I was invited to participate in a project in Israel. This is just after the second Lebanon War. It seemed to be an opening to rethink things, and one of my colleagues, Avner Haramati, with some friends of his, he had been involved for many years in dialogues between Israelis and Palestinians, but he thought that what would really be helpful in Israel would be to organize some sort of a strategic dialogue about the future of Israel with a group of Jewish Israeli leaders. You may know that Jewish Israeli society is hugely divided between religious and non-religious, right and left, settlers and people who live within the Green Line, immigrants and native-born Israelis. And the hypothesis of this group was that until Jewish Israelis had some sort of shared understanding of what they were trying to do, it would never be politically possible to make a settlement with the Palestinians. So we started working with this group, which included leaders of all of these different factions. Now, the two sides of power seemed obvious to me from the little I knew about the Middle East situation. On the one hand, you had in the establishment of the Jewish state after the Holocaust a dramatic example of generative power, of the drive of everything living to realize itself with increasing intensity and extensity. You had this linguistic revival, this rebirth of Hebrew as a modern language, this spiritual revival. You had this extensity with this territorial conquest, first in the pre-67 lines and then into the settlements. At the same time, the degenerative side of power was also obvious. If the Jews were trying to realize themselves intensively and extensively, and the Palestinians were trying to do the same on exactly the same piece of real estate, it's obvious that there would be violent conflict. What surprised me is we could immediately see the two sides of power within this little team. I don't know how many of you have participated in or tried to facilitate meetings of Israelis. It's a very horizontal society. People aren't afraid to disagree at all. We had long debates in this team. And after one of these long debates, a woman came up to me and said, "Adam, I know that I'm being difficult in this group, but I'm not willing to compromise who I am just to get along with everybody else. This is the drive of everything living to realize itself. And if everybody in the team is doing this all the time, you can imagine why the arguments would go on for a long time and become polarized and stuck." So I could see the two sides of power in this situation. What took me a lot longer to see was the two sides of love. The team included members of the parliament, of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and because of the weekly schedule of sitting of the Knesset, the workshops had to be held from Thursday night to Sunday night. which meant that they had to be over the Jewish Sabbath, Friday night to Saturday night. And because the team was about 50% religious Jews, it meant that there was a 24-hour period where we couldn't do any work at all. You're supposed to rest during the Sabbath. You can't write. You're not allowed to write. You're not allowed to use electrical devices. So my first reaction as the designer of these workshops was, this is a disaster. You're telling me we have to have a three-day workshop within... We have to have three-day workshops, but there's one day where we can't do anything. This is ridiculous. And it turns out, of course, that I was completely wrong, that these Sabbath periods were without doubt, and at every workshop, the most productive period. That what people did in the Sabbath is they ate together, they prayed together, they went for walks together, they argued. You're allowed to argue on the Sabbath, that's not forbidden. And it was without exception, those 24-hour periods where the group really became closer, where they were able to make progress, and where there was really a feeling of oneness, sort of a family feeling. And I realized this is exactly what Tillich means by love being the drive to reunite the separated. That in this Sabbath experience, the separated become united, which had, of course, been the premise for the project as a whole. At the same time, there were members of the group, particularly the secular members of the group, that were very uncomfortable with this Sabbath unity. They said quite strongly, look, this unity, this religiously defined unity for this workshop or for the State of Israel is not my unity. This is not the whole that I'm part of. I'm part of a secular unity in my community or amongst Jews and Arabs or the global unity of sociology professors or whatever. The unity that you're defining, I find constraining. So this is the other side of love. And I realized in looking at the macro situation that this question about what's the unity that's separated is highly contested. Is the unity in question here all Jews? Is it all Israelis, both Jewish and Arab? Is it everybody in the Middle East? This is not it's easy to say superficially, well, we're all one. But the question of what's the whole that has been separated and needs to be reunited is a highly contested matter. And what I noticed in this group is that as they worked on their power and as they worked on their love, both of them became more generative. The power moved from degenerative to generative, and the love moved from degenerative to generative, and the work of the team started to flow and become more fluid. So, this is how I am defining power and love, and obviously I haven't discovered or invented power and love. These are phenomena that we all know about, but I think that I have learned something important about how power and love are connected. And it's the following. What is it that makes power degenerative rather than generative? It is the lack of connection or the lack of love. And what is it that makes love degenerative rather than generative? It is the lack of power of self-realization. Martin Luther King Jr., the great theologian and activist, wrote his doctoral dissertation on the work of Paul Tillich. And in one of King's final speeches, his final speech to the Southern Christian Leadership Convention, the organization of which he was president, he says the following. He says, what we need to realize is that power without love is reckless and abusive. And love without power is sentimental and anemic. It is precisely this collision of immoral power with powerless morality which constitutes the major crisis of our time. So this is my understanding of the essential relationship between power and love. The great biographer of Martin Luther King Jr. was a man named Taylor Branch. And Branch writes that he sees King's... the story of King's life as having been about walking a narrow path between reckless and abusive power on the one hand and sentimental and anemic love on the other. And of course there is a great Greek myth about this idea of trying to navigate between two dangers, and this is the story of that's told in the Odyssey of Odysseus sailing the Straits of Messina, this narrow strait where on the one hand there is this six-headed monster with six long necks, sharp teeth, Scylla, perched on the rocks, and on the other hand this monster with a big mouth that when it sucks in water makes a whirlpool, a Charybdis. And the story is that if you're sailing between Scylla and Charybdis, if you try to get away from the danger is that if you try to stay away from Scylla, you end up in Charybdis, and if you're trying to stay away from Charybdis, you end up in Scylla. And this is the image I have of what it's like to try to work with power and love. In theory, it's simple, but in practice, it's difficult and dangerous. Because in many cases, our societies and communities and organizations tend to be dominated either by power or by love, which means they tend to be characterized either by recklessness and abuse or by sentimentality and anemia, either stuck on the rocks or in the whirlpool. So choosing either power or love is always a mistake. When we choose either power or love, we get stuck. And if we want to get unstuck, if we want to be able to move forward on addressing our most complex social challenges, we have to find a way to choose both. Okay, the last part of what I wanted to say is to address the question of what does it take? What, in particular, what does it take as individuals, as citizens, or as change agents, or as leaders, to help the social systems of which we're part get unstuck, to create forward movement on complex social challenges? In other words, what does it take as activists to balance power and love? And what I argue is that we can't do this in the systems of which we are a part if we can't do the same within ourselves. And so the challenge as individuals, as change agents, as leaders, is to learn to employ and indeed embody both power and love. Now, the reason this is difficult, in my observation, is that some people are able to do this, but most of us are more comfortable with either power or love. In a calm setting like now, it seems easy to work with both, but under stress, the power people revert to power and become reckless and abusive, the love people revert to love and become sentimental and anemic. My own particular pattern, exhibited in a very high-stress project in India that I talk about in this book, is that I was reckless and abusive on even-numbered days and sentimental and anemic on odd-numbered days. So the point is, the basic point is that power and love are not a choice, they're a dilemma. And one of the people who's written in a very helpful way about dilemmas, these situations where we have two options and we can't choose one, is Charles Hamden Turner. And Hamden Turner makes what I think is a very helpful note, that often the way to reconcile a dilemma is not to try to do them at the same time. And so the image came to me, which I've used in this book, is that working with power and love is like walking on two legs. So we can't move forward just on one leg. We don't move them both at the same time. We don't stay in balance. On the contrary, we use first one leg, then another. And in a way, we're always out of balance, not in balance or in dynamic balance. I don't know how many of you remember this movie, The Wizard of Oz? Remember this movie? There's this wonderful scene where the Scarecrow is stuck on a pole, and Dorothy takes him off the pole, and he's trying to learn how to walk. And at the beginning, his legs are disconnected, and he falls down, and then he's able to stumble, and eventually he's able to walk and to skip down the yellow brick road with Dorothy. And so the image I have of this is that if we choose either power or love, we fall down. If our power is stronger than our love, or our love is stronger than our power, we stumble. We're making progress, but always at risk of falling. And if we want to walk, we have to be able to use both equally. So I have to say I very rarely think there are recipes in the world, but this particular formulation leads to a very straightforward, although I would say not easy to implement recipe, three-part recipe, which is the following. The first step is to become aware within ourselves of both our power and love. And this means for the power people who think love is just some thing for romance movies to see within themselves this drive to reunite the separated, and for the love people who say they don't like power to realize within themselves this drive to self-realization. There'd be a lot of incorrect analogies in this field, but a very correct analogy would be here to say to become aware of both the masculine and feminine within ourselves. The second step is to deliberately work on strengthening our weaker drive. So for the love people to deliberately work on strengthening their power drive, and for the power people to deliberately work on strengthening their love drive. And the reason this is important is because people normally do the opposite. The power people say, well, you know, I'm not very good at this love thing, and so my power is way out here, and people are always telling me that I'm being disruptive or arrogant or pushy, so I'm just going to try to hold back my power. Or the love people say, well, you know, I don't like to push myself forward. I don't like emphasis on myself. So I'm going to try to be a little less open, a little less loving. And I don't think that's good enough. I think actually what's required, or the aspiration that's required for the kind of work we're talking about, is to move towards 100% of our power and 100% of our love. And the third step is simply to practice putting one foot in front of the other, and in particular, not to choose between or confuse or fuse these two. The counterintuitive part is not to try to move for this perfect balance, but to practice the power, practice the love, practice the power, practice the love until they fuse and interpenetrate within us. The question arises then, why is this difficult? Why do we hesitate to step forward? And I think the simplest answer would be fear. The power people hesitate to use their love because they're afraid of being hurt. The love people are afraid to use their power because they're afraid of hurting others. I had this counseling teacher once, a very difficult class, very emotional. People would cry. And when somebody would cry, she wouldn't say, oh, they're there, why don't you just take a break and calm down. She would hand them a box of tissues and she'd say, keep talking. Talk through your fear. And I think that's what required. There is a very interesting story, and I'll end with this, an interesting story about stepping through your fear. And I was told it in Eilat, which at the third workshop of this Jewish-Israeli group. Eilat is the southernmost city in Israel, right over the Red Sea. And my middle name is Moses. So I've always had big interest in the Red Sea, big interest in biblical stories. And I'm standing at the window of this conference center looking out at the Red Sea. And standing next to me is the oldest member of the team, an ultra-Orthodox rabbi, 85 years old, one of these guys with the fur hats. And I said, Rabbi Pappenheim, do you know anything about Moses and the Red Sea? He said, yeah, I've been studying it for 80 years. I know a thing or two about it. He said, Adam, did you know that when the Israelites were fleeing from the Egyptians and they came to the Red Sea, the scholars tell us that the first ones got their feet wet. Well, I said, I don't get it. How could they get their feet wet? If God parted the Red Sea, how come the first people got their feet wet? He said, well, let me tell you. I mean, there's a story, and then there's the story underneath the story. This is the tradition of Jewish biblical scholarship. He said, actually, the story behind the story is when the Israelites arrived at the Red Sea, it was not split. The water was there, and what did they do? They sat down on the banks of the Red Sea and cried. They cried for Moses or their department head or God to just do something, make a path for us. And it's said that Moses himself had no idea what to do. And the story goes that there was a young leader whose name was Nachshon. And in Yiddish, to call somebody a Nachshonite is to refer to a courageous young leader. The story is that Nachshon, who did not know how to swim, walked into the Red Sea until the water was above his nose. It's an interesting image. Can't swim, walk into the water until it was above his nose. And the story goes, it was the act of walking into the sea that split the sea. So I think this is the situation actually we're all in. We're trying to deal with situations where there is no path in front of us. There is not even a map of a path in front of us. How can we move forward? The only thing to do is to use both of our legs, to put one foot in front of the other, simply to step forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adam. That was really, really thought-provoking and interesting. Now, we've got time, plenty of time, half an hour or so, for questions and discussion. Andrew's wandering around with, roving around with a roving mic. So please put your hand up and introduce yourself before you ask your question. Who's going to kick us off? Fiona, Andrew, sorry, you have to come back down to the front, and Fiona's going to kick us off here. Fiona, you want to say who you are?
Fiona Crawford, I work in the Glasgow Centre, and I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Really enjoyed your talk there. For those of us that work in public health and are confronting, you know, some sort of fairly intractable problems that you know involve a wide number of influences. Many of us are told that we can't really move forward unless we've got good evidence on which to act, and we have this whole evidence-based public health, and we need to, you know, we need guidelines and we need systematic reviews, and that leaves people like me sometimes feeling stuck. What would be your advice? Some of the things we face are, you know, mental ill health, obesity. And, you know, I could give you a whole load of examples. But often, you know, there's big arguments about what we should do because, well, it's not evidence based, so, you know, you can't do that.
I'm aware of this evidence based issue. Although I've never worked with it. And so I'm not sure I can answer your question directly. But I would like to say two things about the more general question of moving forward in the health system. I think a reasonable generalization is that the health system, like many other social systems, is characterized, among other things, by fragmentation, by everybody doing their thing, exercising their power, trying to get their job done, but, again, as a generalization, disconnected from one another. And so some of the most exciting interventions I've seen in health have as their essential rebalancing move what I would call a love move. Now, remember the definition I'm using of love, the drive to reunite the separate. And so any attempt or any effort that brings together people from across a system is, by definition, a love move. Any whole system convening, and in particular, any whole system convening that emphasizes dialogue rather than debate, because the difference between dialogue and debate is dialogue involves seeing from within the other person, which is, again, a love move, a move that reunites the separated. Now, so that's a general idea about unblocking systems that are characterized by fragmentation or by a dominance of power over love. I once had somebody say to me something that really struck me. She said, I've worked as a consultant in lots of kinds of systems, and let me tell you, the hardest kind of system to be helpful in of all is healthcare. Because just when you're getting to the key point, just when you're really getting to the difficult stuff, somebody will say, remember the patients. And this is actually not helpful. And the way I understood this is a way in which love obscures power. In other words, where the emphasis on unity is unhelpful, because of course when King talked about love without power being sentimental and anemic, I think that's actually shorthand, because the power is always there. It's love that doesn't talk about power that's sentimental and anemic. And I highlighted this because this one quote in this book, because I think it's very true and very important for those of us who work in the helping professions. This is James Hillman, the psychologist, and he says something that really accords with my own experience. He said, why are the conflicts about power so ruthless, less so in business and politics, where they are an everyday matter, than in the idealistic professions of clergy, medicine, the arts, teaching, and nursing? In business and politics, it seems, there's less idealism and more sense of shadow. Power is not repressed, but lived with as a daily companion. Moreover, it is not declared to be the enemy of love. This really accords with my experience of working in companies and with politicians. And then he goes on to say, so long as the notion of power is itself corrupted by a romantic opposition with love, power will indeed corrupt. The corruption begins not in power, but in the ignorance about it. So what I am arguing, which I think applies, I think is important, particularly in change work in healthcare systems, is that of these two traps, the trap of reckless and abuse of power without love and the trap of sentimental and anemic love without power, the first is in a way easier to deal with because it's more obvious. And the really insidious one is love that disguises power, as Hillman claims happens, not just in healthcare, but in spiritual work and in consulting, for that matter. I once had somebody say to me, Adam, I'm a priest, and I've worked for the last 10 years with the question of sex abuse by clergymen. And I thought he was going to say, this is a clear example of reckless and abusive power. But actually, he said the opposite. He said, I'm convinced that this is a phenomena that involves people who are uncomfortable with their power. So this idea that love that's uncomfortable with power would become literally perverted. And in a way, this is the strongest message in my book, is that that's the phenomena that is harder to deal with. And that's the phenomena that I think is exhibited above all in change work in healthcare systems. So I don't know whether this was connected at all with this evidence-based question, but I think there's something there that's worth paying attention to.
Thank you. I've got a question down at the front, please. Thanks. You can indicate to anyone else who's wanting to make a point.
It's just something that happened a few years ago. That might take this on a bit and relates to this. I was asked, there was a surgeon, I wrote a book, and I was, at the time I was an inspirational speaker, a motivational speaker, and I was asked by a surgeon to go down and speak in a hospital in Birmingham, because he got angry, and he came out from behind his surgery table, and the waiting time that was taking him to do his work was 49 weeks. Mm. And he went out and he got to know everybody in front of him, he was a vascular surgeon. Mm. So I suppose if you like, extended that off, find out what their issues were. Mm. 3 years later, he cut it down to 6 weeks. Mm. But he was frustrated because nobody would believe him that they could make it work for them. Mm. So I was asked to go down and just, I suppose, spread the love. Mm. The interesting bit was a group of people then said, we want to do something. and can we follow his example? And they worked out between them that the thing that they wanted to do was make more people well. That was their KPI. That's all they said, we want to make more people well. 6 months later, they worked out between them how to cut the mortality rate, people going through operations in half in 6 months. But it's this idea that it's about power, that they actually had the power to make the change. And somehow they found, I suppose, the courage to get past that.
Right.
Yeah, does that make... I suppose what I'm saying is, could you analyse that? Because a lot of people would find it quite difficult to make that leap, but how they did it?
Well, the only thing I'd say is that many change efforts get stuck in moving from insight to implementation. And of course, there'd be lots of things you could say about that, but I think one aspect of this is it's moving from, in the walking movement, that's the movement from love to power, from a sense of connection, of seeing, to okay, what are we now going to do about it, which inevitably involves conflict. I use this image that it's like getting out of a warm bath and putting on cold armor. And I find that many people falter at that point. They don't have the courage, in particular the courage to exercise their power, which inevitably has a risk of hurting people. And so what I'm suggesting is that in a way, the move from power to love is easier, and this move from love to power, which is associated with, okay, you know, to decide means to cut. The word decide means to cut. So to make decision involves exercising power, involves the risk of hurting people. And that's where I find that a lot of these change efforts get stuck. This is getting stuck in love. So it's this capacity to do both moves, the joining and then the cutting, the joining and the cutting. And the reason this is so important in my field is that this is where dialogic work always gets stuck and therefore becomes discredited. And it sounds like the people you're referring to were willing to take that next step, and in particular willing to say, okay, well, we thought about this, let's do something and see if it can work.
Thank you. Andrew, there's another question at the back. While Andrew's walking up, Adam, can you say a bit about the cultural transferability of these ideas, because it strikes me from your experience that you've found these terms and approaches to be effective in all different parts of the world, and yet often when we talk about how we do our work, we're reminded to be very sensitive to context and cultural specificity. So I just wondered if you could say a bit about that.
Well, you know, I think a simple and correct observation is that all situations are the same and they're all different. Somebody once said to me, you know, the Paris fashion show, it's always the same and it's always different. So they're both true. I have worked in a lot of different places, and I focus on what I think is common. I'll just share with you one experience. I went in March for 10 weeks to talk about this book in Asia, and I was excited to go to Asia. I hadn't been there in a long time. But I was also open to the possibility that people would say, you know, nice work, Adam, but very Western, doesn't really apply to us. So I thought it was a good test. And to make a long story short, I found a lot of that the concepts applied fully. But what I realized, which would probably not surprise you, but I was interested to hear with my own ears, that although in the West we see many systems characterized by a power exceeding love, the better known phenomena in Asia, particularly in Japan and Singapore, where I had spent the most time, is of love exceeding power. And I got a very good example. Somebody said in one of these talks, he said, there's an expression in Japanese which means to read the air. To read the air means to be aware of the basic dynamics in a social system, and in particular to fit into it, to be harmonious, the capacity to read the invisible rules and to fit in. And he said, my 5-year-old son came home from school the other day and said, Daddy, if I can't read the air, I'll be dead. And he didn't mean literally dead, but he meant that he'd understood as a 5-year-old that the capacity to fit in, to be one, to not stick out, was the most important thing in life. Now, of course, there's some of that in the West, in Canada, in South Africa, I guess, in Scotland, but on the contrary, there's a lot of room for people who stick out, who realize themselves, who dress in black like my younger brother used to do. I mean, there's a place for that. You might get bullied, but there's a place for that in the culture. And in Japan, there's essentially no place for that. So this, to me, is the same phenomenon, but here where love, and they were very aware of the phenomenon of love undermining power, of unity, which they're so good at, and I saw many examples of that in working with Japanese groups, having the shadow side of undermining power. So, of course, these things are different everywhere, and they're the same everywhere, and what I particularly found is the prevalent malfunction is different in the West than in the East, at least in this little experience.
Thank you. Sorry, I took Chairman's prerogative. Introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, I'm Paula Charlson from the Scottish Environment Protection Agency. I was fascinated by what you were saying about your experience in Copenhagen. Members of my organisation went, I didn't go personally, but a couple of things really I want to ask you. One is whether you can see any glimmer of hope in an agreement coming forward. I think, you know, there was a lot of despondency after the event because we didn't have a global agreement. And I wonder whether you observed what your observations were in terms of where we were moving. My thoughts were, for example, that NGOs, I think, are changing in their approach, particularly in Scotland and the UK, and whether you would say they were the love camp, I guess, but they're actually more informed, more reasoned. They have more discussions with government, so I think they're moving from their power, their love position. But I wonder whether you're seeing any movement from governments, from power to love.
Well, of course, the climate change situation, and I talk about it in my book, is an extreme example of a situation that demands 100% of our love and 100% of our power, because the disconnection, the need to reconnect countries and generations and people to the earth is crucial, and I think it will take all of the power of the public sector, the private sector, the civil society sector to make the changes that are required. So it is a very important example, and I guess as a process designer, I went, I'm embarrassed to say, a bit with the assumption that I find, well, you know, if they had just put me in charge, we could have sorted this one out. And I found this not the case at all, that it was an extremely sophisticated activity. I was there as a member of the South African NGO delegation, so I got to sit in on the NGO strategy sessions, and I found it an extremely impressive global operation with lots of love and lots of power, and I think the same would be true of most of the government delegates. I think we're dealing with a genuinely difficult problem. It's not that people are being stupid. There's aspects of the situation which are genuinely of a scale of challenge that is without precedent. My own view, which I think most people in the field disagree with, is that in a way the breakdown in Copenhagen was helpful, because it probably would be impossible to solve this problem from the top down within the time we have, and therefore the breaking of that illusion that a big deal that could then be implemented from the top down with compliance measures and global agreements is probably salutary, in that now literally hundreds and thousands of bottom-up efforts in all sectors, in all countries, are now unleashed without people having the political limitation of saying, I'd better not make a South African abatement plan because it might undermine our position in the global negotiations. So I'm concerned that we won't figure this out in time, but I'm happy that there is so much bottom-up work rather than trying to do it all in one deal with 192 negotiators, which was obvious to me from just sitting there that this wouldn't, we could do this for years, as we have for 15 years, and not make a deal. So, yeah.
Thank you. Matthew, then Trevor.
Matthew Lee from BBC Scotland. I wondered if you would reflect for us on any experiences you've had working with particularly marginalised or impoverished groups. I wasn't clear whether maybe the work that you've done in Australia might have fallen into that category. My underlying question is there almost a fixed quantum of drive that any group will have? In other words, if they're rather disempowered, they will have a tendency to have a very sustained love angle. Yeah. Or is the definition of an impoverished, marginalised, or the language that's used in Scotland, a deprived community, is it that both of their drives are actually undernourished and underdeveloped, and that thriving communities have within them a greater quantum of drive? I'm working with your terminology for the first time, so forgive me if it's a rather naive question.
No, I think it's a very important question, and I have a little bit of a view on it, but I think this is one of the big challenges in the sort of work that my colleagues and I are trying to do. I last night was at a meeting where the subject was Israeli-Palestinian negotiation challenges, and one of the great difficulties, of which there are many, but one of the great difficulties of this situation is what is commonly referred to as the asymmetry of power. So it's very difficult to do the kind of work I'm talking about with a gross asymmetry of power. Let me just give you an example with two parts. One of the longest running efforts we've had in this area has to do with sustainable food supply chains. And when we started the work 6 years ago, there was one group that declined to participate. It's a big project, has lots of NGOs and governments and environmental NGOs and social NGOs and all the big food companies. And one group declined to participate, which was Via Campesina. Via Campesina is a radical peasants movement. They come out of Latin America, although there's also a European branch. And we spent 2 days with the head of Via Campesina for Europe, and he listened very carefully, and he said at the end, no, I think I won't participate yet. We're too weak to participate in this dialogue. I would like to wait a few years, a few more years of protesting outside food companies until we're strong enough that we can enter into dialogue. So I think the conventional view, which I support, is that there really is a need for I guess I call it traditional mobilizing and power building as a precursor to love-type dialogue work. Now, that said, there is, of course, more than one kind of power, and what somebody observed about this Sustainable Food Lab group is it's not obvious in this group that the corporate people have more power than the NGO people. And in fact, there's a certain sense in which the NGO people are more accomplished and more fluid and more able to do their thing, more powerful than the corporate people who, to make a generalization, are men in gray suits. So I think it's important in these discussions to understand there's more than one aspect of power, more than one way, more than one kind of capacity for self-realization, but that traditional power building or empowerment or coalition building activities are essential. And simply the idea that you get everybody together as they are and it'll work out is not correct in this work. And now in Australia, the work that we're trying to be helpful in, I would say with a great difficulty, relates to the relationship between Aboriginal and settler populations. And this is a huge asymmetry of power, and it's not obvious to me how to deal with this in a practical way. And of course, the first instinct, which obviously has merit of the Aboriginal participants, is let us get our act together first before we enter into this dialogue space. So it's a huge issue, and the ignorance of this issue is what leads most dialogue efforts to be sentimental and anemic, by ignoring the very issue, or by ignoring or denying the power issue, the obvious power issue to which you have alluded. And this is the great weakness of the dialogue field, or the multi-stakeholder field, is exactly the one you wanted.
Thanks, Matthew. I think we have the last question, Trevor.
Trevor Lakey from the Mental Health Partnership in Glasgow. My question, interestingly, is almost identical, so I'll just quickly run through that, because you've answered many of my points. And one of my roles is the suicide prevention coordinator for Glasgow. And my question was, the question was about despair, I guess, in community, yeah. Working with communities who are feeling very, very powerless and despairing, or being the roots to power or blocked. And I guess which is what you just said in response to Matthew's question is very relevant to what I was seeking to ask. But thinking of some of your commentary and Carol's introduction of the areas of work you've been involved in, such as the post-apartheid situation in Rwanda, any further insights you would have in engaging with very marginalised, vulnerable groups whose, I guess, sense of power is that they have none at all, or that they're sense of hope for the future, or ability to co-produce, if you like, is very limited.
No, I think it's a huge point, and so let me say that I don't know, and I think it's a huge area for work and for learning. I'll just offer one little bit of an answer, not an answer to the challenge, but maybe just an aspect of it which is not obvious. I worked in Colombia in 1996, and the work involved all different actors in Colombia, including the various illegal armed groups, the FARC and ELN and the so-called self-defense groups, and he has a lot of stories about that work. But about half the members of the team had lost somebody to the violence. You know, one person's sister had been kidnapped, and another person's son had been killed. And there was a large number of people in the group who had really suffered grievously, and in the most terrible way from the situation. And what I noticed about that is that in a way their brokenheartedness was the doorway to the group as a whole grasping the dynamics and the seriousness and the humanity of the situation and being able to get over their fixed intellectual and political situations. So there's a certain way, under certain circumstances, where the brokenness of people who are suffering, or in a way the brokenness of all of us in certain respects, can be a doorway for this work. And one of the unexpected things in this work, which I wrote about a lot, particularly in the first book, is the way in which the most personal and the, somebody said yesterday, the expression of one's vulnerability can be an enormously potent power move. So I'm saying things which I know are a bit odd and maybe paradoxical, but I've seen over and over that it is the exposure of brokenheartedness which is the which allows movement in a stuck situation to occur, and therefore sometimes it is the quote weakest amongst us which show the way, and I think that's true in a lot of senses, and I'll just say it at that. Thank you. Thanks for the question.
Thank you. On that note, Adam, I was very struck by, in the introduction to your first book, you refer to one of my favourite films, Groundhog Day, and making this very similar point. That, do you know the film, Groundhog Day? Yes. Where Bill Murray is sent out to this far distant place he doesn't want to go to, and he has to film the appearance of this groundhog that happens once a year. And he's desperate to get back home, and the weather traps him there. And the next morning, he wakes up, and it's exactly like the previous day, and he does exactly the same. He behaves in exactly the same way as he behaved in the previous day, and nothing's better, and he doesn't achieve what he wants to achieve, which is to get away from the place, and he goes to bed. And the next morning, he behaves in exactly the same way again, and similarly, he gets exactly the same results. And it's only once he expresses this sort of brokenness and frustration and vulnerability and actually thinks, oh, well, I am here, and I'm going to see things differently, that actually he begins to enjoy being there, and he falls in love, and, of course, there's a happy ending. But I thought it was a very sort of striking analogy and maybe a good link to the messages you've left us with today. Adam, thank you for a thoroughly inspiring seminar. I think everyone's really enjoyed it, and I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank the GCPH team, who once again have put on a great series of seminars, and particularly Andrew and Fiona, our communications manager, who do all of the things behind the scenes that make this go so well. So thank you very much. Keep in touch, and we will reconvene again after the summer with Series 7 and whatever that has in store. I know it will be interesting and thought-provoking, as all the past series have been. So thanks for coming, and let's show our appreciation to our